be a 5-week class instead of a 4-week class. But then I found out that on June 30th, I'm taking my son to camp. So therefore, it is a 4-week class. So,
that's nice.
Well, we'll see if it's nice. Consult me after the drive. In any case, this is now Ramban. This is Nachmanides. We shift our focus at this point from southern Spain to northern Spain, from the 11th century to the 13th century. So we're now moving way ahead. And what we want to see is Ramban, Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, all the same person, and his life and his approach and what it tells us about the Jews of his day in Christian Spain. This is going to be fascinating. I'll begin with this bizarre story. You are, I hope, familiar with the term bageling, right? In which you are identifiably Jewish and you're in some public place and somebody comes up to you and lets you know that they are Jewish somehow. So sometimes that's very subtle, the way that they'll do it. And sometimes it's not subtle at all. I give blood regularly at Hillcrest Mall. And I was there, this is probably 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, my business. I'm sitting there waiting for my turn. And a fellow comes up to me and he says, you know, I'm preparing a speech for the Toastmasters. And I have this text memorized. Can you test me on it? Okay. And he hands me a book. And the book is a Hebrew-English edition of Igeret HaRamban, Nachmanides' letter to his son. And this fellow is practicing it for the Toastmasters presentation. I didn't know if he was pulling my leg or not pulling my leg, but he recited the English, a good chunk of it, by heart, and it was pretty good. Take a look, please, on your sheet. It's source number 4. I brought you an excerpt along with a link to a website where you can find the full text of Nachmanides' letter. I think it's very worth reading just in general. He writes to his son, "Therefore, I will now explain to you how to always behave humbly. Speak gently at all times, with your head bowed, your eyes looking down to the ground, and your heart focusing on God. Don't look at the face of the person to whom you are speaking. Consider everyone as greater than yourself. If he is wise or rich, you should give him respect. If he is poor and you are richer or wiser than he, consider yourself to be more sinful than he, and him to be more worthy than you. Since when he sins, it's through error, while yours is deliberate and you ought to know better." He's telling his son to act, you see, with humility, to think with humility. Leave aside the question of whether it's socially acceptable today to talk to somebody without looking at them and keeping your head down. And I understand that we may not look at this quite the way that it was looked at in the 13th century. But his focus is very much on a person's character, and that's what he's trying to convey here to his son, and that's the kind of person we're going to see. Mariana.
Yeah, us women are taught to look a person straight in the eye.
Yeah, so
down, that means, you know, you can be taken advantage of.
So there are cultural differences here. And I think there are even gender differences in this regard. But I think understanding where he's coming from,
yes,
you know, you certainly can see that.
Is the same as Maimonides?
So the iddies at the end of their name is the same, but everything else is basically different. In the sense that we're going to see Rambam, Maimonides, represents the rationalist side of Sephardic Judaism. Nachmanides represents the mystical side of Sephardic Judaism.
Do they still practice that?
Oh, you'll see. We're going to talk about it. Maimonides is very open, quotes Aristotle and Arabic philosophy and so on. Nachmanides is more conservative. But one of the things that I hope to get to is that in Nachmanides' day, there's a lot of controversy about Maimonides' writings, and Nachmanides tries to come to his rescue. So it's not as simple as two opposite sides, you know, feuding. It doesn't work that way. Rose.
I just want to say, I mean, Rambam is very much different in personality than this. He's exactly what you would see. He's authoritarian. His opinion counts only. I mean, he wrote Torah, and he said nobody else needs to even look at anything else. So very, so to me, that speaks to a real Sephard, fiery, blah, 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 and this is completely not what I expect of a Sephard. This is completely against...
That's very interesting. So I think we need to be a little more nuanced, and nuanced within Maimonides also. You're right that from a scholarship perspective, Maimonides brooked no fools and was very, very confident in his positions, and it gets him into a fair degree of trouble. But there's more to be said about both of them. And, you know, someone asked me if I was going to give a series next year, maybe on Maimonides, but I explained that, we had just a few months back, Rabbi Sammy Bergman did a series on Maimonides. So I think I'm going to wait for a while before I revisit the topic, but let's talk Nachmanides and the 13th century. So first of all, Jews and Christians, Spain in the 13th century, the area we're talking about in northern Spain is a set of provinces. As we said last week, you don't have a united country of Spain at that point. Spain is united under the Habsburgs in 1516. Until then, you're talking provinces. The even when we talk about 1492 and the expulsion of Spain, it's not a unified country at that stage. What happened was, under the Catholic kings, at the end of the period of the Visigoths, so you're talking the end of the 6th century, Jews suffer horribly, forced conversions, expulsions, so much so that in the year 711, when you have the Muslim invasion, the Arabs and the Berbers, the Jews actually welcome it at that point. They're very happy. War continues between the Christians and the Muslims for the centuries thereafter, and in a lot of that time, Jews are doing okay, like with Shmuel HaNagid, largely because each side needs them as allies. The problem comes in the middle of the 13th century, because in the middle of the 13th century, by that point, most of the provinces are Christian. The Christian conquest, bit by bit, works its way south in the Spanish provinces. The term for it, anybody know the term for this conquest? The Spanish term? The Reconquista, right? That's their term. So I'm going to share the screen with you, if Zoom will comply. Yes, Zoom will comply. You should be able to see on your screen this very cool map that I found online. I gave you a link to it in source number 5. This is an amazing map. This is really good work. In which the artist has tried to show you, and I'm going to move some things out of the way on my screen. I don't know if they're blocking on your screen the way they are on mine. It's not really going to help, but a little bit. There, that'll be better. So he tries to show you the waves of conquest as the Christians move south, so that you have this little red area at the top that I'm pointing to with the arrow. That's what Christians control in the year 750. And then you move your way south, the orange area in the year 800, and then moving down to the peach area in 1043, the yellow area in the year 1100, the green area in 1148, blue area in 1213. By the time you hit the middle of the 13th century, they're well into the pink area. So most of it is at this point Christian. You can see Granada down at the bottom, and that, of course, is the last Muslim holdout area until Ferdinand and Isabella take it to complete the Christianization of Spain. But if you take a look back at the top now, where I'm looking for, there we are. On the eastern part of it, you see where it says Aragon? So that's the area where Nachmanides is. Is that area up there, which has been solidly Christian at that point for quite a while. And that's the area that's going to be our focus here. So I'm going to stop sharing the screen, but again, the link is on your source sheet, so you can admire the map later. Okay, but I thought that was an incredible map, no? Sorry?
They have mountains in Spain.
Yes. Yes, they do. So what happens is, as the Christians become more powerful, they don't need the Jews anymore. And the result of that is that you see more oppression again and more persecution again. So that in the year 1250, Pope Innocent IV, I always hate that when you see Pope Innocent. You know you're in trouble when you're dealing with a Pope Innocent. So Pope Innocent IV issues a decree against the Jews in Cordoba for not wearing the Jewish badge, for living in some cases, the same house as Christians, for eating with them and generally associating with them. They, at this point, things are not so good. So that's the background in which Nachmanides is operating. He was born in Girona in the year 1194. He was the grandson of a great rabbi, Rabbi Yitzhak ben Reuven of Barcelona. His cousin, who will come back into the picture later, was Rabbeinu Yonah of Girona. Some may be familiar with his work of ethical instruction, Sha'arei Tshuva, Gates of Repentance. That's Nachmanides' cousin. Nachmanides studies philosophy. It seems he studied medicine as well from some of his writings. He was a very witty person. It shows up in all of his writings. He's very sharp. He's also stylishly poetic. Some of his poems have emerged. Some of his writing, his Jewish writing, his rabbinic writing, is poetic. His introduction to his comments on Maimonides' collection of the mitzvot is like that. You also see the poetry in a prayer of his, which was discovered in a manuscript several years ago. I gave you a link to it in source number 6. I didn't want to spend time on it now, but you may have seen it at the time. It made it into Times of Israel and all those places. They uncovered a prayer that Nachmanides wrote, which you can find online. Susan.
You said about the Jewish star wearing it. Why? How long have Jews been forced?
So the Jewish badge, if I remember correctly, goes back to... Yeah, the Jewish badge goes back to Caliph Omar, the Pact of Omar. So you're going back to, if I remember correctly, I think, I don't want to get this wrong. I hate it if I say something wrong. So look up the Pact of Omar and you'll see there. It depends on who is implementing it. Pact of Omar requires it for Christians and Muslims, Christians and Jews under Muslim control, that they dress differently. That's what Omar requires. And then the Christians pick it up and require it of Jews and Muslims under their control. It went back and forth over time. It wasn't always a badge. Sometimes it was a certain color. Sometimes it was a hat. There were different requirements in different areas, meant to keep Jews from mixing with whoever the superior population was, meant to degrade them in certain cases, in certain areas. The badge is a very, very old thing. There's a lot to be said about it. We did a series way back when at Beth Emeth on Jews and clothes, and I gave a class on the Jewish badge. It's sometime back. Yes, Rosalind.
When did the Muslims come to Spain, please? You mentioned the date, but I didn't catch it.
Oh, 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven.
Like the store?
Yeah, like the store. I'm going to give you a link, if I remember, in the follow-up email to my class on the Jewish badge. If I uploaded it at the time, then I'll find the link and I'll include that, because there's a lot to be said about it. But yeah, there was a particular invasion in 7-Eleven when they came in. There were territories in the north at that point that were actually Basque, but that's a whole other discussion. So Nachmanides, he had a secular name. Very few Jews are aware of this. His secular name was, I didn't put it on the sheet. I thought I had it there. Bonastrug de Porta. Oh, I did. It's in the heading over number 4. Some actually identify him with somebody by the name of Astrug de Porta, who was a member of a big and influential Aragonese family, which would mean that he came from a very influential family. But it's really not so clear at all. Historian Robert Chazan of New York University disagrees and says it doesn't actually fit. And we could go into the back and forth, but it's not so germane for the study of Nachmanides for us to debunk a name that wasn't his. We don't know the name of his wife. We do know about some of his children. We know he had a son named Nachman, right? He was named for Nachmanides' father. Nachmanides himself is Moshe ben Nachman, so he names his son Nachman. That's the son to whom he sent the letter that we mentioned earlier, with instructions to read it weekly. That was what he wanted his son to do. He had another son, Solomon, who went into the service of the king. And he had a daughter who married the next chief rabbi of Gerona, Rabbi Gershon ben Solomon. That leads some to think that the commentator, biblical commentator Ralbag, was his grandson. Because Ralbag is Levi ben Gershon, some suggest. Right? In any case, unclear that that's true. He was mentored by Rabbi Yaakov ibn Yakar, who is Spanish, as well as some of the Ashkenazi authorities. And here's something of particular interest. We're going to have to come back to this later on. But you have to know a little bit about the Ashkenazi leadership of the time. The Ashkenazi leadership of the time, rabbinic leadership of the time, consisted of those who were known as Ba'alei HaTosafot, authors of Tosafot, of additions to the Talmud. And what happened was, Rashi had grandsons who became the nucleus of rabbinic scholarship in Western Europe. They were based primarily in France and Germany, but you have some in England, and you even have some who make it to Israel. Nachmanides trains under some of them as well. He starts to publish rabbinic literature at the age of 16. And this is classic Sephardic literature. I don't know how much detail is too much detail here. I have a feeling like it may be too much.
It's good.
Okay.
We don't know any of this.
That doesn't mean it's not too much. But Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi was the leading sage in Morocco in the 11th century. He was also known as the Rif. He put together a magnificent collection of Jewish law. He was actually the mentor of Maimonides' father, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi was. And there was another sage shortly thereafter, Rabbi Zrachya Halevi, who wrote a criticism of this work of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. Nachmanides writes a work defending Rabbi Alfasi's work against the criticisms that are raised by Rabbi Zrachya Halevi. So it's a commentary to a commentary on that. And it's a remarkable work that is studied to this day in yeshiva. So this is what he wrote at the age of 16. Today, people who are, you know, who are 60 struggle to follow all of the ins and outs and the scholarship that's in it. He becomes the rabbi of Gerona. Now we're back in Nachmanides. Then he becomes the rabbi of all of the region known as Catalonia. And he becomes a big inspiration for others after him. Some think that he was also a physician. He did write about the laws of medicine. In a work called Torah HaAdam, he discussed the philosophy of medicine within Judaism and how am I allowed to practice medicine, God is the healer, and so on. So some suggest he actually was a physician himself, which is an interesting possibility. Right now I'm just giving a basic digest of his life. We're going to have to come back to some of this. One of the major moments in the life of Nachmanides was when he was banished from Spain. That can be a major moment in someone's life. Just when you think about sort of the milestones, there's graduation, getting married, getting banished, things like that tend to stand out in a biography. Well, anybody know why he was banished? So
After
the disputation. So we're going to come back to talk about the disputation itself. But he ends up forced into a dispute with the Christians before King James of Aragon. And when he publishes his manuscript of the debate, which shows him winning the debate, unsurprisingly, he ends up banished from Spain. From there, he goes to Israel. Israel at this point is under the control of the Mamluks. Nachmanides was always a big Zionist. He's not the first one in Spanish Jewry when you think of someone like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who preceded him. But he was a very strong Zionist. If you take a look at source number 7, this is a great example of his belief that Jews belong in the land of Israel. he's commenting on a biblical verse which commands the Jews who are at this point in the wilderness on their way from Egypt into the land of Canaan. There's a mitzvah that commands them, go settle the land. So Nachmanides says, regarding this, in my opinion, this is a commandment, meaning it's not just a prediction, I'm giving you the land. It's you're required to live there. It instructs them to live in the land and settle it, for God has given it to them, and they should not reject God's lot. If they should decide to go conquer Babylon or Assyria or some other land and live there, they would be in violation of God's command. Nachmanides says, there is a mitzvah of living in the land of Israel. This becomes a subject of very interesting discussion as to whether this is a mitzvah still, is it binding on Jews today, and so forth. It's a great discussion, not for right now. But Maimonides' point, and what I'm trying to show you here, is that he believes that Jews have a mitzvah of living in the land of Israel. And then if you take a look at source number 8, he quotes you a midrash. There's a verse in Deuteronomy which is said as part of the Shema every day, in which we are warned that if we don't keep the covenant with God, we will be lost from the land. So look at what he says here, quoting a midrash. He says, Deuteronomy 11:17, this is source number 8 on the sheet. Deuteronomy 11:17 says, you will be lost quickly from the land. Even though I exile from this land to live outside the land, be marked by the commandments so that they will not be new when you return. What Nachmanides is saying here is make sure that when you are living in exile, you still keep the commandments so that they won't be new for you when you come back to Israel. Absorb that for a second. What does that mean the status of mitzvot is outside of Israel? Correct. It's practice. What we're doing when we live outside of Israel is practice for when we come back. That's the philosophy that Nachmanides espouses, in this case quoting a midrash that preceded him by a large measure. But that's what he builds up. You follow? So, for him, it's natural. Kicked out of Spain, where am I going? I'm going to Israel. Well, he first goes to Jerusalem. The problem is that the serious Jewish community in Jerusalem was driven out during the Crusades. There was still a small Jewish community until the Mamluks invaded in the year 1244. So that Nachmanides writes a letter to his son telling him that when he arrives in Jerusalem, he finds only two Jews. Nonetheless, he restarts the community. Anyone here ever been in the Ramban Shul in the Old City? Ramban Synagogue? So believe it or not, the Ramban Synagogue in the Old City in Jerusalem is the same one that he had built in the 13th century. It is, as I understand it, the second oldest synagogue in continuous use in Israel. There's one that's older. It's the second oldest. Unfortunately, he felt that the community really wasn't sustainable, and he moved to Acre. Acre is written in English, A-C-R-E, right? Familiar with it? Acre is a major port, a commercial hub. It had a crusader fortress there. And the Mamluks were steadily destroying the last crusader strongholds in Israel in this period of time. Right now, it's still held by Christians, that fortress, until the year 1291. But Acre was a thriving center of Jewish life. And here I come back to the point that I made earlier, where I said to you that Nachmanides had some training under the Ashkenazi Tosafot. So some of them were actually living in Acre. They had come there from France. So Nachmanides comes there, and he makes a major splash. Everybody's interested in Nachmanides. Karaites came to his lectures. Karaites, for those who are not familiar, were a sect of Jews who did not believe in rabbinic teaching. They only believed in the biblical text and a certain set of interpretations, and that was it. Nachmanides lives in Akko until the year 1270, possibly later. The last attestation we have that he's alive is the year 1270. He dies in Akko and is buried in Haifa, which is right nearby. Akko is northern Israel on the Mediterranean coast.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Mariana, that was what you were going to ask?
Yeah. Is it the same as Akko?
Yes. Yes, that's the one. Okay. In Hebrew, it's Akko, but yes, A-C-R-E is the way that they write it in English. So Nachmanides, that's just a little bit of a bio, okay? So he's, again, he's born in Girona. He grows up in Spain, becomes a major figure in the province of Aragon, writes and develops great scholarship, becomes a leading rabbi there, the chief rabbi of Catalonia, and ultimately moves from there to Israel when he's kicked out of Spain, and first in Jerusalem, and then finally in Akko. That's just a little bit of biography. But now let's talk about him as a community leader. Nachmanides was connected to James I. James I respected Nachmanides greatly. James was a little bit of a wild card in the world of Christian monarchs. He sometimes supported the church positions, and sometimes he chose not to. He consulted Nachmanides on matters that relate to the Jewish community, and it seems in general on political practice as well. He would consult the Jewish community. By the way,
is this James I of England or James?
Aragon, A-R-A-G-O-N. Yeah, the province, So he quotes Nachmanides on matters that affect the Jewish community and in general. I brought you something on the sheet because I can't help wondering if this played into the advice that Nachmanides used to give James of Aragon. This is, you can see, from Nachmanides' commentary to the book of Bereishit, to the book of Genesis. He's talking about the fact that the Torah presents mitzvot that are for every human being, not just for Jews. They're known as the Sheva Mitzvah opening Noach, the seven Noachide laws. And one of those laws is to establish laws and courts. There's a responsibility for all human beings, all human civilizations, to establish laws and courts. But the question is, what exactly is Judaism asking of them? What are they supposed to do? Is it just set up laws that protect the other Noahide laws? In other words, we have seven Noahide laws. Not, example, not to kill, not to steal, not to worship idols. So is God saying, I want everybody to create laws around don't kill, don't steal, don't worship idols, and so on? Or is it more broad? Create laws about speeding on the roads. Create laws about whatever. So Nachmanides was very broad. In source number 9, he says, in my view, the mitzvah of establishing laws, part of the seven Noahide laws, is not only a mandate to establish judges in every region. God instructed them in the laws of theft, fraud, cheating, employee wages, and guardians. All of this is included. He had a very broad belief in social legislation, and I wonder if that plays into his counsel for James of Aragon. Well, James really likes Nachmanides. So that after the disputation, which we mentioned before, when Nachmanides publishes his account and the church is very angry, they put Nachmanides on trial for publishing it, and James disbands the court. He disbands the court. He says, I'm the king. You can't tell me what to do. It doesn't work long term, but that's his take there. Unfortunately, as with Shmuel HaNagid, we find that there were Jews who also created problems for Nachmanides. Just like Shmuel HaNagid had to deal with Jews who were jealous of his position, so too with Nachmanides, there were Jews who were jealous of his position. He got involved in various controversies. One of the controversies involved a family known as the Al-Constantini family. If you have access to the following book by Jacob Rader Marcus and Mark Saperstein, it's called The Jews in Christian Europe, a source book 315 to 1791. It's a very, very handy resource. The this controversy happened at a time when the philosophical writings of Maimonides were very controversial. Maimonides writes a lot about philosophy. First of all, he has Mora HaNevuchim, Guide of the Perplexed. That is all philosophy. And then, even in his legal work, he includes elements of philosophy. So, so a lot of it was very controversial. It was controversial because he quoted Greek ideas and he quoted Arab ideas. And in some cases, he agreed with them. So that makes for certain challenges. Well, you have a family known as the Al-Constantini family. They were a very politically connected family. And they were supporters of the writing of Maimonides. They believed very much in Maimonides' ideas. On the other hand, we mentioned Nachmanides had a cousin, Rabbeinu Yonah, from Girona, who was in the opposition. In the 1230s, Nachmanides is still relatively young, Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed was published in Hebrew. Originally it was written in Arabic. So it was published in Hebrew, sparking opposition from those who didn't want it to be spread. Okay. By the way, just in case you're not aware, under reactions at the bottom of your screen, there's an option for slower and there's an option for faster. If you feel like something needs to be repeated and you don't want to interrupt to say so, you can hit slower on there and I'll get that message. 20 people jumped for the slower button. Okay. So, again, what we're saying is there's a controversy in the 1230s because Guide of the Perplexed from Maimonides is being published in Hebrew. And, again, first of all, this is way before the printing press. Published means that it's been translated and then people are rewriting it. It's not published printing press. But you have the camp, including Nachmanides' cousin, who are opposed. And then you have the camp of people who are supporters, like the Al-Constantinis, who love this. Nachmanides is brought in, even though, again, he's relatively young. He was born in 1194. At this stage, he is maybe 40 years old. He's brought in to mediate between the two groups. It's going well, until the Al-Constantinis make it personal in their attacks on Rabbeinu Yonah. And at that point, Nachmanides turns on them. They had claimed the status of what is called in Hebrew the Nasi. Nasi is political leader of the Jews. Nachmanides wrote that they were arrogant pretenders. He called them Ishmaelites of the royal court. That was his term for them. And he intervened with King James. They wanted a certain position as Dayan, as judge in the Jewish community, and Nachmanides intervened to block it. Well, they continued to be active despite his opposition and despite not getting that that position. But I want to talk about the actual philosophical controversy that led to this. Maimonides, Rambam. They was, as I said, a philosopher who quoted ideas that people did not immediately recognize as Jewish ideas. He was a rationalist in his reading of biblical text, in his reading of rabbinic writing. He was a strong rationalist. He had a philosophy about things like free will and divine control of the universe that did not fit with what other rabbinic writers of the time and before him were saying. As one example of where his rationalism got him in trouble, he wrote in his work of law, the Mishneh Torah, that God does not have a body. There is nothing physical about God. Now, today you look at that and say, well, why is that a controversy? That makes a lot of sense. And to him it made a lot of sense also. He said, look, anything physical has to deteriorate. He knew the Greek science of the time, and he said, if it's physical, number one, it has to deteriorate, and number two, it can be divided, and God is one. So therefore, it must be God doesn't have a body. Ah, but the Bible in various places talks about the hand of God and things like that. He says, okay, fine, it's metaphor. It's not meant literally. That's what Maimonides said. And further, Maimonides said, anyone who believes that God has a physical form is a heretic. So there. Well, Rabbi Avram ibn Daud, who wrote the definitive commentary on Maimonides' work of law, Mishneh Torah, when I say definitive commentary, it's the one who has pride of place in standard printings of Maimonides and who disagrees with him frequently, says to him, you know, this is what he writes, many rabbis who are greater than you said that God does have a physical aspect. So there, that's more or less what he wrote. And that's one of the areas in which Maimonides' writing is very controversial for the positions he takes and for the way he takes them. So that what we're going to talk about next time, because I see it's 10:59, and like I said in the beginning, I have to go promptly. But what we see here is that there is a radical trend in Maimonides' writing. Nachmanides is conservative and mystical and has a very different philosophy. And that leads to a lot of back and forth between the different camps that we'll talk about. And so what I want to do next time is, first I'll try to do some kind of a recap of what we did this time about Nachmanides, because I know it was a little quick. We'll talk about the Maimonidean controversy, the controversy over Maimonides' writings. We'll talk about the disputation in the year 1263, which is what Nachmanides got expelled for. We'll talk a little bit about his ideas and his philosophy before we move on to Don Isaac Abarbanel, who is really supposed to be the focus next week. Okay? So we have a lot to cover. As I said in the beginning, I do have to go. But what I'm going to do is pick somebody responsible to make them host.